Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which three random guys read science fiction novels, then subject you to our more or less fascinating thoughts about them. I am joined, as ever, by Barry and Kevin. By the way, this is our more or less first anniversary.
Woo!
Yay.
Yeehaw!
I never thought it would go this long.
And so, yes, I believe that we're celebrating in the traditional manner by more or less forgetting and not actually doing anything. So, I didn't get you guys anything.
I got myself something.
There will be fallout later.
There always is. Okay, so, you know, not to get too personal, but today we're discussing you. Actually,
the alternate version.
We are discussing the novel You by Austin Grossman.
Why you, indeed.
Y-O-U. Also sometimes called You a Novel to make it slightly easier to search for.
Great. Sort of like our podcast, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast.
Search yeah. via SF3.
Yes, in fact, I was thinking about that very similar joke. Equally difficult to search for.
Kevin, would you give us a reading of the back of the book, please?
Indeed. When Russell joins Blackguard Games, brainchild of two visionary designers who were once his closest friends, he reunites with an eccentric crew of nerds hacking the frontiers of both technology and entertainment. In part, he's finally given up chasing the conventional path that has always seemed just out of reach, but mostly he needs to know what happened to Simon, the strangest and most gifted friend he ever lost, who died under mysterious circumstances soon after Blackguard's breakout hit. Then Blackguard's revolutionary next-gen game is threatened by a mysterious software glitch, and Russell finds himself in a race to save his job, Blackguard's legacy, and the people he has grown to care about. The bug is the first clue in a mystery leading back 20 years through real and virtual worlds, corporate boardrooms, and high school computer camp to a secret that changed a friendship and the history of gaming. The deeper Russell digs, the more dangerous the glitch appears, and soon Russell comes to realize that much more is at stake than just one software company's bottom line.
Well, that sounds like a roller coaster of adventure.
Whee!
Barry.
Yo.
Tell me what you thought of You.
About me, myself, or you, the novel?
I don't know, whichever you like.
I don't know. People should send me money. I think that's what I think of me.
Good.
Or not you, but me. But when you refer to me, she should say you.
Pronoun panic.
Yes. It's all quite confusing.
So, Barry, what did you think of You, a novel?
It was okay. I mean, I think the last third was a bit disappointing. It just kind of fell a little flat. I felt like they teed up a bunch of great stuff and then it just didn't follow through on the swing or something.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty legit review. I have a very strong love-hate feeling about this book. Every part of it, I think, is absolutely fantastic. And then when you stack it all together, it kind of makes me mad. Because, like you say, there's a lot of stuff that sort of gets teased in the beginning, put into motion, and then it all just doesn't kind of pay off in an interesting way. In terms of prose, this is amazing. This is like James Joyce type of stuff. You know, we have a lot of, okay, maybe I'm,
yeah, that's some high praise, my friend.
Sort of rocked back, and maybe, you know, maybe my hate has driven my love a little too far.
It's like an ever-increasing oscillating orbit.
Exactly.
Well, it does, I mean, you know, I was thinking about it. It didn't occur to me other when I had read this previously, but yeah, it's very like avant-garde in a way in its structure.
Right.
And I mean, it's obviously, it's written as if it's a game, right? You know, when they say, oh, the voice of the game early on in the book is
right.
First, second, third person, that kind of jumps around a lot.
Exactly. So every choice that it makes is somehow justified in the text. But a lot of it is this very obviously autobiographical, very detailed vision of what it's like to work at a game company and the people that you meet there and the kinds of things that you can run into there. And then there's what seems to be like this interesting kind of quasi-science fictional subplot and all of this interesting discussion about what games are and what the perfect game would be.
Like what narrative is and that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And then
it didn't get any better after Ultima 3.
Right. And then it just, it doesn't go anywhere in the same way that I...
But see, that was like very meta avant-garde, Steve, because he says, and that's what happens with a lot of games, they just end. And then they don't have a great payoff at the end.
I mean, okay, then I respect your choices and still am kind of mad at the book.
So but I didn't buy a game. I bought a book.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't mean to buy a book about a game.
Plus, there is, I am happy to suspend my disbelief at any particular level, but this book jumps all over the place. There are intrusions of fantasy. And then there's, you know, very careful play-by-play as to exactly how he played this particular game at this particular time. I can't even necessarily tell whether I should recommend this or not. I'm not sure that I recommend it as an audiobook. I think that sitting down and actually reading this might be worth it.
Well, I will say that the actual physical book, there are parts where they jump, like we said, between first, second, and third person. Like there's a part like right at the beginning of the book where they jump into sort of like text adventure mode where it's like, you know, you see such and such, you know, go west. You see such and such here.
Right. And I'm sure that that's all
it's italicized and like different font or something in the book. So it's like, it makes much more sense in print than at first it does when they're reading it in audio, I think, even though I think the reader does a pretty good job overall.
Right. Although I do want to call out that thanks to the reader, I can no longer say the proper name of a company that friends of ours work at called NVIDIA, but he refers to it as
NVIDIA, Steven.
NVIDIA.
Yeah, I know. I've gotten over that.
I can't blame the guy. He is speaking a language, and this book is not written in English. It's written in our language, whatever that would
be. Like the editor V, and then yes. And of course we're like all.
I was just like, what?
I'm like, was that intentional?
Nobody else would know except us and programmers that is supposed to be called VI. Of course,
and yet the
replacement
the hand,
Vim is called Vim. It's not called VIM or something. So whatever, but.
But he also refers to the Commodore PET.
Yes.
That's true. That's a little more ambiguous, but apparently that is an actual acronym.
Well, yes, that's
it's
true.
It's not just PET, so even though everyone calls it the PET. But.
And then there were a few other words that he kind of, the narrator biffed a little bit.
Right.
Like hexagonal. I'm like, what?
Yeah. That's my normal job of nitpicking that stuff, but I like this book so much that I don't care anymore about that stuff.
Right. Sorry, so I stole your job.
I know. Over to you for your proper opinion.
Right. No, I mean, I think this book is actually amazing. And like, actually, I've read like half a dozen times now. And like each time I read it, I like it better, I think. So now I'm into the, you know, your space vampire mode of like, this is the best book I've ever read. And but actually.
This is the, you know, another of our bizarre lexicon terms. The space vampire mode is just really liking a book.
Yeah.
Well, it was the only paper book that was in the house for like 3 years. Yeah, so you just read it continuously.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I will say the first time I read it, I liked it also. And those little nitpick things jumped out more that time. But I think it really evokes, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people talk about it as being nostalgia. And yeah, sure, it evokes a lot of nostalgia with early 70s, 80s, like game players and people who tried to write games, which is probably everybody that had like, you know, BASIC on their computer and wrote crappy adventure games.
Mine wasn't crappy. It was awesome.
Mine was great. It was 2001, A Space Odyssey, written in AppleSoft BASIC. Just like the book itself, it kept on getting slower as I added more detail to it.
Mine was written in Logo just so I could draw the obelisk.
Wow. Yeah, I had low-res graphics on my BASIC adventure game. It was pretty awesome.
Sorry. Yeah. Even though I contributed, I do have to call a halt.
Okay, fine. But yes, I think it, you know, it evokes a time period. It evokes, you know, this thing. But it also kind of comes across, and like we were saying, kind of like this bizarre avant-garde writing style, which, I mean, some people might interpret it as just bad writing, but I think it was like...
I loved it.
Jumping between first, second, and third actually kind of was appropriate most of the time, I thought. And it also kind of, I mean, in a way, it made me really depressed because like it's like stuff that I always wanted to do as a kid. And you know, like, hey, I'm going to start my own game company and do all this stuff. And I never kind of really got around to it somehow. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah,
but you know, in a weird way, it also like invokes this bizarre, like ennui, like just of like the time period, kind of like Stranger Things, mm-hmm. kind of evokes that time period. So I think it does a really good job of kind of evoking that, you know, experience of, you know, going through that time period, playing games, kind of this early computer stuff, what it was like.
Right. But yeah, one thing I do want to get across is The back of the book makes it sound like a thriller or a mystery, and it is absolutely not that.
I would recommend you don't read the back of the book before you read the book, actually.
Even though you just read it out loud.
Yes. Do not listen to this podcast.
You have made an error.
Until after you've read the book that we just mentioned.
Yeah, I think this book, I think it's kind of a niche book in my mind. I think it really appeals to people like about our age. People were born sort of maybe in the, you know, very late 70s up until about 1980, you know, sort of like the golden age of computer games was exploding outwards and some really neat things were happening.
As I said at one point, we are the best and worst people to review this book.
I mean, I think someone, you know, like not to pick on millennials like everybody else does, but, you know, I think that they would probably look at this book and go, yawn, right?
Well, like some of the other reviews that we've read kind of are like, I couldn't get past like 10 pages of the book. And I'm just like, what do you mean? This is awesome.
I mean, this book actually caused me to go back and reinstall Angband on my computer after, you know, maybe just only a couple years out. But
right. And it's weird because, I mean, every time I've listened to this book, I almost always immediately go back and re-listen to it again, like right afterwards. And I started playing Pathways in the Darkness because I was actually looking up this thing about Wolf 3D and I always misremembered something about the dating on that. And anyway.
All right. Yeah, I think it's time for us to go grind the lich into our discussion zone. We shall return for We Are Sci-Fi.
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 Welcome to Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi. This is our discussion section where we all discover that life was really the game all along.
God, I wish.
Not the game of life?
Not the game of life. You mean the board game? They don't discuss board games very much.
A little bit, but yes, not much.
All right. So normally we, I think, discuss favorite scenes here. So does anybody have a favorite scene? Well, let's see. So my favorite scene was at the beginning of the book. I really liked it where he's just finished an interview that really wears him out quite a bit, both sort of physically and emotionally. And he's just wandering home and wondering what he's going to do with his life. And the world sort of transforms into a text adventure. And I thought that that was done sort of really subtly. And I actually pulled the same kind of trick at one point during a senior paper of mine in school. This is the terrifying part. You know, the fact that it was addressed to you was seemed perfectly natural to me because the main character, Russell, is me.
Yes, that's true. So I guess we already answered that question. Well, it is funny because even I remember in one of the other books, we were talking about hypertext fiction and stuff. And I was like, this book would have, you know, been this crazy hypertext thing back in the day almost. Right.
Absolutely. Let's see. Kevin, what's yours?
So, you know, I had more than one, but I think probably one of my favorite ones was early on. They're talking about, you know, what makes a game and narrative and stuff and plot. And they're like, well, you know, this other company, they just basically do a bunch of crappy Doom clones and there's no plot. And that's why we're going to win, you know, our company in Black Arts, because, you know, we do plot in our games. And so you actually do stuff. And one of the programmers, you know, she basically comes up and she's like, you know, plot sucks. And they're like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, plot's what, you know, is going to make, you know, games great, just like movies and books and stuff. Nobody will takes us seriously now because we just run around and kill things and like, you know, but plot will be great. And, you know, she kind of goes about how like, look, I'm 12 and I want to play a game. So, you know, bing, you know, it takes 2 seconds to load up, you know, Doom and I'm running around shooting things. And look, let's load up our game. You know, it takes like 3 minutes just for it to launch. And then you have to go through all these like cut scenes, listening to people. And then they're like, explain who you are because apparently you don't know yourself. And then it's like been 10 minutes and nothing's happening. And you don't even have a sword yet. And he's like, you know, now I've already quit the game because it sucks. I'm like, and,
that's why they now have the quick start feature.
Right. And it's like, you know, I kind of am more with Russ on this that, no, I think plot matters, but I think that there's a major point to be made that, you know, it's like, what is a big thing in the whole book is like, what is your story? You know, it's like the game might not be your story. You know, he's like, you know, maybe, what was the line where he's talking about, You know, you're going over to grandma's house and, you know, there's a wolf there and stuff like that. And so, you know, maybe you're Red Riding Hood, but maybe you don't want to play that game or do that story anymore. Maybe you just want heroin or something like that.
And you want to be a heroine?
Well, I think he said maybe, you know, you just want heroin and more heroin or something like that, you know, and that's your story that you want to play. So, you know, you don't care about grandma anymore or whatever. So they were kind of talking about, you know, like the game, the plot that a game presents to you as opposed to what's your story.
Yes. Well, and we should hold off on the whole, you know, open game, just want heroin discussion.
Well, that wasn't a major thing. It was just sort of a joke.
I'm just starting to want some is my point.
I just pawned grandma's dentures. And so they're like, go get high.
You know, they asked the programmer, well, you know, what's your favorite, you know, game that you'd want to do? And she's like, you know, I would go around and kill everybody in the entire world. And I thought that was funny for two reasons. One, because it was just funny, but also because I used to do that when I played like Ultima 3 and 4. I had the version that was my regular.
No, Your Honor, there were no warning signs.
I had the version that was the full, you know, four discs or whatever of the regular game. And then I had a copy that I just labeled kill copy, where I went around and tried to kill everybody in the entire world. And I was always mad that you couldn't kill the shopkeepers because they were like not actual characters. They were just sitting on the screen, waving their arms back and forth. And
they weren't sentient. Is that what you were saying?
I guess they were not killable. And, you know, a few of the people are flagged killable in their ways.
You didn't
to kill
have Morn Blade.
Well, actually, in Ultima 4.
Oh, dear God. No.
Yes. In Ultima 4, there's this
what
thing
have
called
you done?
The Skull of Mondaine, which, which is this thing you're supposed to just destroy, like, in order to get into the abyss. But instead, you can walk around and just use it, which just kills everyone in the entire town. So it's pretty similar to Morn Blade.
Okay, Will. Barry, please talk. Say a thing.
A thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
What was your favorite scene?
Okay. So, Barry, what was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was the E3 convention demonstration.
Yes, that was one of mine as well.
they're trying to pitch their new game at E3, and they're sort of like small potatoes. This is and the timing seems like it's right just before, you know, the console wars really started heating up. Mm-hmm. You know, this is when right before, you know, right as Microsoft and Nintendo and Sony are all entering into the
it's like 1997, 1998, around that era.
Yeah.
And it's really important because they've just had sort of a company split and all of their major designers have left. And so they have to really wow the audience.
Yeah. Right. And this is after the bug has been, the big bug has been discovered.
Right.
And he's up there and he's trying to demo the game, and it's supposed to be like in this, you know, demo loop thing where he kind of runs around and does a certain number of pre-prepared actions. Right. So they know they've vetted it, right? This is like any good demo.
Right. If you've like ever done a times. Software demo, then this is actually what happens.
Right. Until the actual event happens, and then nothing happens like it's supposed to.
Right.
But during the demonstration, the bug basically manifests itself.
Right. And the bug is just basically, you know, there's a cursed sword that people pick up and, you know, then they become immortal and kill anything that moves.
Right.
And so he's trying to narrate his way past this. Oh, looks like she's picked up that she's got a sword. And now the blood there, that's, it's all particle based. Yeah.
See all the textured blood on the walls?
Right.
Exactly.
No, she's on fire. Notice how it just spreads as she hits things. Like, you know.
They're like, look, the boat's even on fire on the water.
Right. And so the game is burning down and everyone is being, you know, is bloody and dying. And it's supposed to be sort of this, you know, relatively sweet adventure.
Right. And, you know, the princess falls in love with him. Instead, like, you know, the blade is, you know, running amok, and he shows up to see the king, and he's like, you know, oh, whoever has such and such, which you have, like, you know, can have the hand of my daughter. And then he gets killed. And like, it's like, oh, he's like, I'm trying to pivot it. What was this vile betrayal? And everyone knows he's just like, you know.
And the audience is like, they're just kind of like loving laughing. It, right? They're like, right. They're like going, kill him, everybody, kill everything.
There's nothing better than watching a demo just completely, you know, self-destruct.
Go up in flames, yeah.
So he's like, well, we got a lot more press than we thought we would.
And so, yeah, I did like that was a great scene. I But that was one of those things where that was a very realistic moment, even though it was sort of a little over the top in some ways, in a good way, shall we say.
Right. So another reason I like that scene is it's the point in the book where they kind of come to the realization that they've missed the boat.
Right.
Literally on, you know, trying to get into the consoles and, you know, this sort of era of crafting these sort of games that they've been doing for so long. The era is like a bit over.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and then to me, that's like sort of the cycle of technology, you know, that longer cycle of technology that a lot of people often miss, right? They, you know, like some of us, you know, are probably obviously from the storage background, you know, working for a major storage vendor, you know, and how, you know, they basically got their lunch eaten by someone else, not to name names or anything.
Well, yeah, it's definitely because, you know, they started very, you know, ahead of everybody else with the early technology that Simon had written, you know, for the game engine. And, you know, he had this whole simulation engine and everything that was great. And, you know, now it's causing them trouble.
Ironically called the waffle engine.
Yes.
That's ironic because we all used to work on something called the waffle engine.
Yeah. So, but anyway, yeah, so it's
well, I think it just goes to show that, like, just because you're first into a genre or a niche or, you know, something doesn't mean that you're guaranteed any longevity in the tech world. And
right. It's like
sort of really just like kind of pass them by without them even noticing.
Yeah, it's like you can be way ahead at the beginning, and then, you know, before, like you said, before you even notice it, suddenly everything is obsolete. And, you know, they even talk about that in the book with, like, hardware. You know, it's much easier to see that happening than software, I think, where
right.
It's like, you know, they're talking about, you know, well, we need to do a new game engine because, you know, the stuff that looked amazing and new last year, now that same technology looks crappy and old, like, just a year later. And,
right.
You know.
Yes. So I wanted to talk about the bug a little bit, which was the sort of major sort of standard subplot of the novel,
right.
Which is, so there's a hidden item and it was put there by the original creator of the game who died under slightly mysterious circumstances. And
yes, they never really actually said, but it was like, I think something to do with elevators. Like,
right. He fell down an elevator shaft, and that was one of the big sort of, you know, unrung bells in the, or something like that, where they just never actually indicate anything about, well, why did he die? I assumed that that was going to be like the central plot of the book was, how did he die? Oh, he's actually uploaded his consciousness into this game.
You know. That's your standard plot solution.
It does solve everything.
But you're right, because I kept saying, what's, you know, the next big thing, he had it, and then that would have been, I guess, one way to make it more science fiction-y.
I kind of expected like him to have uploaded himself into the game and would become the AI that would, you know, run all games in the future. And we got to end the book. I'm like, what the hell?
Right. It just sort of,
that's
like
part two.
Foomp. And yeah. But also, okay. So that was the glitch, was this artifact that would appear and then a random mook right. would pick it up and just kill everybody around.
Basically become the most powerful being in the entire game.
Right.
Right. And it would just regenerate you'd get the hit points of the person you killed. And so just kind of continually regenerate you. And it's, you know, it's a reference to the Elric of like Melnibone series,
mm-hmm. which always seems to me like a dog food.
Yeah. And the funny thing is I've never actually read those. And it's sort of like, I'll read those at some point and then I never have for whatever reason.
I haven't.
Yes, I also have not. So I just had this thing, and maybe he actually explains it in the book, but I don't understand. So eventually he figures out the coordinates of this sword.
Right. In the game.
In the game. Why can't he teleport there?
Right. Well, I think all of us had this issue, and they did say in the game, the waffle engine put hard limits on how far you can teleport.
Right. But then there was another scene, and here we are in Nitpicker's Corner, yes. So just buckle in for a minute here. There's another scene where I believe Lisa,
she was the other programmer, yeah.
Yeah, she was the programmer. She had just written basically a debugger that teleported to a different portion of the game.
Yes.
You know,
that was within that limit, Steve, come on. No, I agree. It's the kind of thing where it didn't bother me as much this time as it did the first like few times I read it, basically, because as a programmer, you're thinking, just go in and change it in the hex editor or whatever, you know, right. And then you're there.
And I mean, if Lisa had left, if they were just a bunch of designers stuck with an existing game and that's all that they could do, that would have actually worked for me.
Right. I think this was definitely half of it was it works better with the plot if it just works this way and you can't just teleport there. You have to go through this whole thing. You know, we have to have a way to make Darren come back for the kind of climax of the...
Right, and I'm quite...
I would have just reset Zero to the actual sword destination and just started the game up.
Yes, I mean, once again, best people and worst people to review this book.
Right, I mean, part of it is, you know, after doing, you know, a little bit of machine learning and other things, I'm like, okay, let's just say that he had some weird kind of AI slash... you know, neural net or something underneath the hood, in which case that's one of those types of technologies that you can't just say, oh, this is how it works inside. You can kind of grasp a little bit of how it's working, but you can't really just say, oh, by tweaking this one variable, it will make it work. It's like, you can't mess with it that way. So I'm like, part of me is like, well, being an apologist for the narrative, you could say if it used something like that internally that you can't understand very easily, then okay, maybe you can't just teleport there.
Right. Know. But in which case, I mean, I would have been happy enough with a hand wave.
Right.
And he had just said, well, why can't I teleport there? And the answer was, oh, because of reason X. It could have been because of applied phlebotomy.
I figured it out. It's because the number he would have had to enter, because he couldn't do it in exponential format, would have been an overflow for the input mechanism.
Ah, okay.
Damn. Once again, if they had actually said that.
I mean, yeah, they and I enjoyed their, as you said, their grenade jump for the ship and stuff like that. And
you detonate a mine directly behind yourself.
Yeah,
it was to propel you forward because the faster than.
Right. It was a Kerbal Space Program trick.
Right. So it basically part of the reason I liked what actually came out in the book was it went into all these things that actually happened with, oh, the engine doesn't let you do it this way, even though you want this effect, you're fighting against the technology. So you have to fake it.
But that's my problem with the level of suspension of disbelief.
Right, right.
At one moment, he is being incredibly realistic about game mechanics.
Right. No, I agree. And it's, like I said, it doesn't bother me as much anymore, but at first that was like the major, that you just have to kind of go la, 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 like, you know, okay, I can't just change my location or whatever. You have to play through the simulation engine because it actually doesn't keep a map. It like, you know, generates it on the fly and won't let you just teleport there or something, you know, okay, maybe I'll kind of believe that. And like you said, another thing is like, okay, let's say the programmers there just didn't know the engine well enough to do that, because they did kind of say, well, this guy trying to do the whole, you know, faster than light travel, spent, you know, weeks trying to just get that one part working.
I'm not even sure that my hate should be counted against this book. I think that my sort of reaction should probably be considered a compliment to the author.
Well, I know what you mean. It's sort of like, it was the largest, like, obvious plot hole.
Right.
And you can go with it or not is kind of how, you know, it plays out, I guess.
Yeah. And there were,
and you know, it didn't, like I said, at first it was kind of one of those, well, why couldn't you do that? That's dumb. Maybe it could have been resolved in a way that it wasn't an issue, but on the other hand, it's like, it's fine, you know?
Right. Then the other kind of problem that I had was, we have a very, once again, fairly realistic narrative that does, you know, play a lot of narrative tricks. And then they will just occasionally go into a narrative where the game characters are real and show up in the guy's apartment.
Right. I was thinking that's almost like it's going the other direction, right? It's like, instead of you sort of, you know, going in and controlling the game character in its world, it's like now the game world characters like come back the other direction into your world or something. I mean, it's like a weird like narrative device, you know, to talk about stuff, but it is weird because they, you know, It was very much a, I wouldn't even say Philip K. Dick thing. It's more of just a, oh, people, you know, he doesn't even blink that, oh, I'm hallucinating, I'm going crazy. It's just like it was a normal thing that the game characters like would randomly show up at his house and talk to him about it. You know, it sounds more like William S. Burroughs or something.
My brain keeps on flipping back and forth. It's just like, what a bold choice, how avant-garde. Jesus, I hate that.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting thing, and at first I was kind of like, what's going on? Is he playing the game? Is he dreaming? You know, yeah, some of it was.
At first, because he was saying, oh, and that, you know, that it was happening right before he fell asleep, I thought, I think we actually talked about this back when we first read this book. Yeah. And I was saying, oh, no, that was just a dream. And it's
sort of that twilight between, you know, right. waking and sleeping.
And then it happens again.
The hypnagogic state bearing.
And possibly. It's not just interludes. It's just like, oh, and then I started to date the main character.
Right. He goes on a date with her. Weird. Yeah. He's like, so she's like, I don't really want to marry you. I want to just, you know, go around and kill be a things. Warrior queen or whatever.
Then like, he gets also, then there's his relationship with Lisa, which, you know, like he goes along and, like Lisa is basically yelling at him for being a jerk and for,
Back in the day, yeah.
Back in the day, and for abandoning all the geeks. And I've got to admit, that kind of hit a little bit home for me. Because, you know, there was a time in high school, it's just like, well, I'm not going to use these silly computers.
It's just a passing fad.
I'm an artist now.
yeah.
A writer. Okay, I write on a computer, but...
Wow, it's like a self-admission.
But right after that, he... like asks one of the game characters, well, should I date Lisa? And I'm just like, what? That's not where your relationship is right now. And then that just sort of like, it's just like, oh yes, you absolutely should. And then nothing happens.
Well, at the very, very end, they kind of hint that they might be dating or that there's some possibility of that.
Right.
They mentioned, you know, they kind of say like, oh, well, there's this girl sitting next to you that has been there for 18 months and isn't totally disgusted with your presence or something. And, which sounds like obviously they want to date.
That's
right?
True love. That's true love right there.
But
non-disgust is all I'm going.
It's not that I'm in love with you. It's just that I, you know, tolerate you.
Yeah.
But
propinquity.
Well, I guess they said, you know, and she stayed up till 4 a.m. to help to watch you play a video game or something like that. So that sounded at least a slightly longer than.
I don't think I know anybody in my life who would stay up till 4 a.m. to watch me play a video game, much less like play Ingress or something.
but yeah, it was not. It was very, very subtle and very unclear whether they were dating, whether they might date or whatever. Right.
Once again, I go back and forth. Oh, it's good that they don't overemphasize that relationship. Just do it or not already.
It's given you the choice.
Oh, God in heaven. Yeah, everything can be. I guess I also wanted to talk about sort of the concept of the ultimate game.
And sure.
I remember that when we first read this, I think I missed certain portions about it, but I thought, oh, this is true. We really should have open games that you let you do anything you want. Then it was fairly recently that they released Infinite Sky, I think it was called. It's a game that a PS3 or a PS4 game that let you explore this wholly computer-generated universe where you come down and it's just computer-generated aliens and you interact with them however you want. And people hated it because there was no plot.
Well, yeah, and I kind of agree with not the hating part, but the whole, like, that seems like the ultimate game. It should be fully simulated. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you need to have some kind of narrative generation. I had this like really clever way, which I'm not going to tell anybody about how to do that, but
the Kevin method.
I have yet. Yeah, no, it's one of those sad things that literally like 25 years ago, I came with this great idea that I don't think I've seen people do, but you know, I guess I haven't paid that much attention lately. Like, I'm just sad. But anyway, one day I'll do it. I'm not like Simon at all.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that eventually you're saving it up for that really great moment of anger when somebody else actually does it.
Exactly. I'm pretty good at that.
Like, that's the payoff.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, look, somebody else did another idea that I had that I didn't do.
So what you're saying is we need to pay for to send you to like Kidbits, you know, camp or something.
Exactly.
It's too late.
I'm kind of a combination of
adult,
you know,
bits,
of
which has entirely different meaning.
We'll get to that. That's the next section, I think. Well, yes. Yeah, so what is the ultimate game? So a more roundtable question. Barry, for you, what would the ultimate game be?
I don't know. I mean, I played an awful lot of Choplifter when I was like in the seventh grade, I think.
Choplifter is awesome.
Choplifter is great. I think we can just stick with Choplifter as the ultimate game.
It's got a goal.
Well,
it's very straightforward.
You can rescue the hostages, or if you push down too hard on the joystick, you can kill them all.
Yes.
Well, that only happens when your thing is full. And for the longest time, I was like, how come, like, I, you know, it makes a different noise sometimes? And I finally figured out, oh, because the helicopter was full and I was crushing everybody, but I thought I would just picking them up.
I'm now experiencing regret for having gone through with this question. But once Choplifter was mentioned, there was really no other path.
Yes.
You know, Like I said, I mentioned, you know, I reinstalled Angband and probably played way too much this last week while listening to the book. And, you know, I'm trying to find a copy of Bard's Tale I could play on my Mac.
Yes.
What
you
else?
Get it.
You know, Ultima 3.
Yes, they even mention Ultima 3, you know, in the book as being, you know, kind of the classic, which I think it's mostly true, Ultima 3, Ultima 4.
I mean, I have to say that, like, after that, I really can't think of too many games that I was really infatuated with.
Portal 2 was my last big game.
Lode Runner
was cool, but I think that was even before Ultima 3.
Well, they mentioned Archon, which I only played a little bit.
Oh, and yes, I believe that in our last podcast,
we mentioned...
I was trying to remember that. Oh, yeah, Archon, that was it. Like, that thing where chess people play each other. Well, it was funny because that's what he says at the beginning of this book.
Exactly.
So this is like extra meta where at the beginning of this book, they ask him what the ultimate game would be, and he basically describes Archon. They're like, you mean like Archon loser? And he's like, oh, yeah, right.
You know, and you know, so like even games I bought later, because I remember at one point I saved up some like fairly significant amount of money at the time to buy like a copy of, like Skyrim or something,
mm-hmm.
or some Skyrim style game where it was right. like this huge universe of, you know, stuff to do with like lots of different, you know, quests and goals and things like that. And I sat down and played it for about 6 hours. I'm like, this sucks. I want to return it. Well, I was kind of mad about that. But
well, the problem too is I think there's definitely kind of like where you are and how much free time you have and stuff, you know, with what you're currently doing. So it's like, as a kid, adventure games were awesome because it's like, look, there's 150 hours of gameplay and you might just be even more if you go slowly. And like,
oh yeah.
No. And you know, so back then it was like amazing to have, you know, it's like, look, I'm not done. Yeah. I'm still not done. Cause like there were some games that adventure games that I played through in just a few days. And then I'm like, oh, well that's dumb. And like,
yeah. So I think a lot of the games that I really enjoyed that I would, you know, sort of put in that category or genre of ultimate games, are games because it was a new thing,
mm-hmm.
right? It was like, I just never done it before. So you could spend, you know, 100, 200 hours, you know, screwing around with the game and discovering all the ins and outs. And it's like a nostalgia thing too.
Right.
Right. So, you know, anything that comes later is just like, well, you know, it's just derivative crap.
Well, it's the sort of thing where you always want a certain amount of novelty and a certain amount of familiarity. But you don't really want to have to go through all of those challenges to master a new game when it's just giving you the same thing that the previous game gave you.
Yeah, right. And I think even like in, you know, 10 years, you know, I'm gonna look back at, you know, something like Ingress, right, which is an augmented reality game. Hmm. You know, I'm like, hey, this is really new and neat and novel, and you know, I already kind of looked down on Pokemon because it's just, you know, literally is derivative crap. But
yeah, those guys stole that idea.
Yeah, they stole all the data from Ingress anyway, and how dare they make more money?
Yeah, just for the record, we all do know that it's the same company.
Yes.
Well, yeah, and even like looking back a few years ago, it's like, oh yes, Cookie Clicker and stuff like that. That, you know, now, I saw that and I'm like, that is the stupidest thing ever. But I find myself playing it over for months at a time.
Minimal
like,
effort games. Yeah,
you know, or
yeah.
What was the other one that was?
Oh, Dark Room.
A Dark Room, yeah, that one. But
Dark
the one,
Room was actually a really good game.
It was a really good game. In fact, that was one of my favorite games for a long time, you know, before that, like, it was, oddly enough. But, I mean, it was very minimalist and pure.
Right. Well, so A Dark Room, for anyone who was not familiar with this amazing bit of gameplay history, was it starts with just a room. You know, it's a room where the fire has gone out, and you add more wood to the fire, and the fire grows brighter. And as things get warmer, then you can do more things, and more people come in and out of the room. And you then wind up, you know, dealing with the town, and the world sort of gradually gets larger, and you get to explore it. And so then there's this huge backstory.
And it's like new interface bits get added very slowly but very organically into the game, as opposed to like, here, read this giant manual and you don't understand how anything works. You know, it's like it kind of just, you know.
Right. And so it sort of avoided more naturally the sort of the problem of, well, you can start with either being, you know, this really weak character that just gets kicked around a lot, or you're the super powerful character, but you have no idea how you got to be the super powerful character.
Like Candy Box was another incremental game, I guess they call it, or clickers, or idle games. And there's something weird about, I mean, I wouldn't say that's the ultimate game, but it's kind of like, it's the ultimate idle game where it's like, look, I can play just by having the browser window open, and like, I feel like I'm accomplishing something you know, overnight by just leaving the browser window open and like the numbers going up, which is a weird, like tricking some internal something.
And, yeah, I would leave, you know, I went to bizarre lengths to keep a browser window open so that I could, you know, have more and more candy. And it's just like, okay, I'm going to go away for a while. And you'd get this sort of burst of reward.
Right. You'd afterwards. Come in, you'd be, I would be, this kind of sense, like, I'm excited to go to work so I could check out Candy Box. And like, what?
It's been running over the long weekend. Let's see how much I've earned.
Or it's like, I left it running over Christmas break. Yes. I have like 5 billion pieces of candy now or whatever. Like,
yeah. It was weirdly rewarding and yet just always sort of whetted your appetite for more, which is the terrible thing.
Right. You know, I also found that game interesting because it was kind of like almost the exact opposite of something like Myst, right? Where you had to sort of spend like, a lot of attention and energy to play, right? I mean, it was very pleasurable to do, but you had to, you know, look at what was going on the screen and, you know, really, you know, think about what order you wanted to do stuff in.
Right. Whereas with Cookie Clicker, I got rather severely obsessed and like had this spreadsheet.
The golden cookie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was this spreadsheet that would that would tell me exactly what I should buy next to get the most cookies.
Yeah, I remember you got a little bit. Then at one point you're just like, I'm formatting my hard drive.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, done. I'm done. I got to stop.
And then it'd be like, no, Steve, I found a new one.
Like, yeah, I'm just like, no, gonna kill you now.
Just had to hack the cookie and just reward yourself.
Yeah, it was not good. But yes. Now, in the book, there was, you know, the sort of like, well, the ideal game would be just like if I could kill everybody, you know, so you
kill copy.
It's kind of amazing how many. I think there would be quite a few people where it's just like, oh, the ideal game that would be just like my real life, but I have a gun and no consequences.
God. The best game would be where you sit in traffic commuting, which I think someone did finally do a commute game.
Oh, God.
But it's like I think, you know, all the random ones like Cow Clicker or, you know, Goat Simulator. And
right.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just the simple ultimate game would be kind of like Realms of Gold, you know, with like a simulation engine that constructed narrative and stuff. But was a fully constructed narrative, like internally consistent, not having to have someone add it on top. But, you know, assuming you like that kind of thing.
Now, this is the rare book where I actually have no idea if anybody ever mentioned tea or not.
I kind of tried to keep an eye out. Then it was mostly, you know, a little bit of coffee, mostly like Mountain Dew and
this was a like Mountain
soft
Dew.
Drink, you know, programming and thing. So I
lots of Skittles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember tea.
These were 20 somethings in the late 90s.
Yeah, so
no tea. Probably I didn't hear of any tea.
Okay, this is a no tea book. Where this is the finally official
a book I can like.
So another completely kind of random thing that I wanted to touch on a little bit was, you know, so they have the four main game characters that are kind of, you know, part of their IP that goes between, right, you know, Brennan the warrior, Prendar the mage, Lorak the thief, and Layra the princess. Slash warrior, like warrior princess. But so kind of a weird thing that happened early on in computer games and is some of the characters often were named after, you know, number one, people's D&D characters.
Right.
Which was, as they say in the book, Brennan was named after Simon's old D&D character. But another weird thing that happened was they just said, well, let's just turn your name backwards. That's a character, right? So, you know, they say Lorak is Carol backwards and Layra is Ariel backwards.
Did you ever have a Nivek character?
Yeah, that was the name of like a robot that I made. It was called Nivek.
Was it like Neptar, the never-ending pie-throwing robot?
Yes, we just stuffed pies in here. And now Prendar, they said in the book,
Irob the warrior.
Prendar, the mage, they say, quote, no one knows where Prendar comes from. And so the first time I read the book,
dear God.
Yeah, I know, we're going to go into this. I said, well, that's weird. What is Prendar backwards? I'm like, it's backwards Radnerp. I'm like, well, Radnerp doesn't make sense, but if you flip the P upside down, it becomes Rad Nerd. So my guess is that's what it was from.
The reason I believe you is because it mirrors the structure of the book almost perfectly. It's a long, very carefully detailed journey that is ultimately slightly disappointing.
So we
That's why Jane 23 wasn't Jane 64.
Exactly. But anyway, so back to the real world things. If you ever played Wizardry,
Don't think I ever did, except maybe at a friend's house that had a Commodore 64.
I did. That was like the first game that I actually got the first big game that I remember I got for Christmas. And it was like, wow, I finally got this awesome adventure game. And like a friend of mine had it. So, one of the bad guys in Wizardry is called Wordna.
Terrible.
And the name of the subtitle of Wizardry is something about the Mad Overlord. The Mad Overlord was Trebor. Well, the creators of the games were named Andrew and Robert. Guess what those are backwards. Like, so that was like a pretty major game, you know, I mean, back at the time. And of course, I think they still make new Wizardry games, don't they? At least they did up until pretty recently, if they're not.
Mm-hmm. Like Wizardry number 62 or...
I don't know.
Or they just start switching to years to...
It's gone through several instances of IP purchase, but...
And yeah, they did have some fun in the book talking about they had these four characters, and the four characters were just used absolutely everywhere, including the golf game, the skateboarding
Realms
game.
Realms of Golf, which was kind of amusing Realms of Gold play. And it's only funny because like they actually had that kind of stuff back in the day, and like I think even like there was a game that was like Mario teaches typing that Interplay did. But I did appreciate the pro skate Midoriya grind the Archlich. weird spin-off games like that were pretty popular, black carts racing. And I thought it was funny too. They even, the Uber fan Matt and the main character come up with we think that these games take place in this weird like sub-dimension that's like parallel to the plot of the regular ones. They just get like randomly teleported out of,
yeah, and I think
the fantasy
that
or whatever.
And some ways you and I are Russell and Matt.
Wow. What does that make me?
I don't know.
Because I couldn't decide who I wanted to be or who my favorite
character
was. I
think you're Darren. I don't know. I would probably be Simon, actually, but
I think you might be Lisa.
I might be Lisa?
Lisa Muckenhaupt or whatever.
Muckenhut?
Yes, I could not quite figure out how it was spelled because I don't have the actual book with me, but...
Well, thanks. I don't know.
I'm gonna let you decide.
Don, the fourth founder of Black Arts.
Yeah, we shall now officially move into the segment of who are we in the game? I mean, there's no question. This guy's Russell's life mirrors mine on a very eerie level.
Well, you would be Russell.
Well, I mean,
you? No, you.
I can't share the experience of having this bizarre feeling of the rest of the world suddenly being melting away and becoming some sort of solipsistic hallucination right now.
Well, that part definitely sounds like a PKD thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I would, I mean, except for the whole elevator accident and, not everything, but there's definitely some Simon in there, I think. Yeah, a little bit of the, a little bit of Russell, but I think a lot of Simon. Although, of course, I would want to be Prendar the Mage.
I just want to be the Mournblade.
You would be procedurally generated in the world no matter what somebody did.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, also, we're all procedurally generated in the world.
Laying waste to everything and everybody.
Also true of all people.
Yes.
It is how I prefer most of my books to end.
Well, I guess in that case, you could be Adric, who's the guy who's sort of like... the spurned version of Simon that sits in Adric's tomb with Mournblade, waiting for the end of the Third Age. Yeah, actually,
this is a man who has trouble remembering the names of his own friends, but
I do have as you said, they are written down on a piece of paper in front of me.
Perfect recall of
so let me write down
random
Steven
elements from games
and Barry so I don't forget your. Yeah, that it is weird because I think I got it more this read through that. It is a weird, it's like a weird mashup of, sort of, well, this is what happened in this one period of this person's life, but also like, this is kind of what it was like earlier in the person's life. And a weird mix of, here's all sorts of weird, like fantasy and space plot lines thrown in and how they kind of apply to the person's life too, as like allegory or not. And So it's kind of like this weird mix of like, you know, fiction, nonfiction kind of feeling to it in weird ways that I kind of liked, and also mixed in with like, and then here's 3 pages of reading the rule book, which yes,
this is really, the Kevin book,
which really made sense in the context of this book, you know, where it's like, you know, they're talking about people reading the rule book instead of playing the game and stuff like that when they were kids.
It was really just like a very perverted version of Tron, right? Where instead of you going to the game came to you. And
I mean,
the MCP.
Actually, apparently he was thinking about Tron quite a bit when he was writing this book.
Yeah.
But yes, when I think about it, yeah, that's a book sort of weirdly written about me and for you, Kevin.
And there I am just watching from the outside going, you guys are crazy.
And well, that is a valid, valid assessment. All right.
The audience is nodding in agreement.
Before we close, I do want to kind of go into my other favorite part of the book, which would work as sort of a standalone short story or novella or something, which was the computer camp
fanfic
section. Yes. You know, it's basically the part
where they... seamier side of Kidbits.
Yeah, they go to Kidbits computer camp, which they didn't say exactly how long, but it seemed like it was a couple months or something like that.
They actually were so convincing on that. I actually looked up to double check that there never actually was a camp called Kidbits.
There were a lot of things that, you know, were true. Like, you know, during Kidbits, he mentions, right, you know, he's trying to that Electronics Arts ad that was, I didn't know about it, but the first time I read it, I looked it up in my stack of Apple II magazines that happened to be in my garage. And like, yes, that was a real ad.
Oh yeah. No, Mr. Crackman.
Oh yes. They listed all the people that crack games, like Mr. Crackman,
the double-sided discs that you would clip off one, you would clip off the other side so that you'd have a double-sided disc.
That was a very late 80s nostalgia thing for me, right? Oh, it was like, you know, you load up your copy of, you know, Mr. Hex Edit or Apple Nibble or, you know, all these other, you know, awesomely named tools that these people wrote.
Right. Locksmith? I forget. There was some...
Yeah, Locksmith was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, I never went to a computer camp, but it's the kind of thing that made me wish I did and kind of in retrospect. And it's kind of like they go through... It's like the... sort of like the joy of programming condensed into like this little short story section of the book of like, just like, you know, creating something, you know, or like a bunch of people coming together, like designing something and then playing the game. And it's like this, like, it's awesome writing it and it's awesome playing it at the end where they're having this tournament. And so, yeah, I thought that whole section was really awesome.
All right. Well, I believe it is time for us at Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi to take on the ultimate game. The game called Life.
I'm just going
to
remove the floppy disk from the drive and turn the computer off.
Make sure that Mournblade sticks around, though. Yes. That'll fix everything.
Oh, it will. Until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.